Hi everyone, and welcome to this session, which is going to be an open discussion with today's speakers, Ruth Gregory, Francesco Di Filippo, who are in person, and Xavier Camé, who is online. Let me maybe start the discussion with a question to all speakers. I would like to ask you, what is your opinion on what's the most important aspects of black holes to investigate from a theoretical point of view and in the light of future observations? Maybe Ruth can start.
So, well, I mean, I guess you got the impression that I'm really into black holes. I guess I'm going to pick on something slightly personal, you know, that I'm involved in. I think that in terms of thinking about black holes and in ways in which the quantum aspects of black holes could bleed out into things that we might see, you know, is I would like to think about the impact of discreteness on black holes. And to that end, I'm part of a consortium called Quantum Simulators for Fundamental Physics. We is a bit generous to myself, I'll be frank, but we're building a black hole simulator that is made out of superfluid helium, which is then going to have quantized angular momentum. So I think for me, although I know that at the analog gravity simulators, there's a sort of question to how much they really tell you what's going on with black holes, because the systems are different. I think what I find interesting is that they might give us just a few clues or some insights into the impact of discretization. That's not going to help us with astrophysical black holes, but I think it's a very interesting theoretical question and one that personally, you know, I find fascinating. So I wait to see what the others are interested in.
Francesco, next.
Yeah, okay, I don't know if this is the most important, but as we've seen from my talk, I'm interested in the singularity problem. And as you mentioned, we have now observation problem. We can observe something, right? So I think the most important is how to bridge the gap between quantum gravity or whatever, regularize the singularity and the observation. There is a lot to do there. So first, today it was time to discuss how to construct viable solutions, but then also we need to really think about the difficulties that experimentalists face, because sometimes I think there is not much discussion between experimentalists and theoreticians, and this leads to these two problems. So sometimes we think we know something that's an experimental result, but instead it's not so clear because there are effects that go there. So I think we should think about observations and how to link the theory and observation.
Thanks, Francesco. And next, Xavier.
Well, okay, it's maybe a very personal question that shows that I don't understand very much those GR simulations of black hole mergers, but I'd be very keen to understand how to calculate either modify gravity effects, high curvature effects for mergers of black holes. From what I understand, there's a lot of extrapolation being made in numerical GR to understand the last phase of the mergers. And I wonder if there's not a chance to see signatures in that last moment, basically, but that would require some actual calculation. Is not just numerical and not extrapolation from pure GR.
Thanks, Javier. At this point, I would open the discussion to everyone. And to this end, let me also mention that Xavier might have to leave earlier. So if there are any questions to Xavier, please post them first.
I'm actually fine. I managed to organize myself.
Okay, so okay, great. Then you can, I know that there are a couple of online questions, so maybe we can start from there. Johanna, can you give the microphone to Mark?
All right, thank you. So there is an anonymous question to Xavier, but maybe giving the opening statement, Ruth can also comment. And the question is whether there are analog systems that could probe quantum hair as Xavier described them in his talk?
So this is very far away from my expertise, but the little I understand about it is that there's hope indeed, and there are claims at least that you can observe Hawking radiation or the analog of Hawking radiation in these systems. And I'd be very keen to talk to these people at some point to see whether there's any chance to see whether those corrections might be observable. But again, I am not very much on top of things there. I'm sorry about that.
So just also to add to that, I mean, one of the things that's very difficult in analog systems is to get a perfect horizon. And so that makes it, if you like, in some sense easier to explore phenomena that arise from a non-perfect horizon. So although we can't say it with any confidence yet, we're seeing things that look a bit like the black hole bomb instability and also echoes. So some of these more interesting phenomena around black hole horizons, I think, could potentially be explored, but it's early days.
Maybe. Thank you. Yes. Are there other questions? Oh, yeah, there is a question by John, and then Robert.
So this is for Xavier. I have to object to the effect of field theory calculations. And the reasoning is it's, some parts of it are technical, some parts of it are pretty simple. The simplest part is in your non-local action, you have Riemann tensor, log box Riemann tensor, for example. And that is a beast that almost nobody knows how to define even. The two tensors are different space-time points. Are there Wilson lines between them? What is log box? What are all the tensor indices? However, I know what you do because it's something I have done in the past. Also, you approximate that by the flat space log box, which is a known quantity. However, and there are regions of parameter space where that's acceptable, but those regions do not include any spaces that have horizons. That's only valid when the metric itself is small and you can do perturbative expansions in the metric, not in the curvature, in the metric. And the net result of that, when you do a static log box, is it has a power law dependence, goes like 1 over the distance cubed, and so it in fact sees into the interior of the black hole, and I believe that's probably why you see results from the interior, is that's probably inappropriate version of log box at that point. There are somewhat more technical ones, points about the expansion of the non-local action. The terms, the log terms, are actually supplemented by higher terms in the Barvinsky-Vilkovsky expansion, R cubed over box, for example. And those also become equally important at the horizon. So the expansions that you're doing are not appropriate for situations where the metric becomes large like it does at a horizon.
So, I mean, as I mentioned, there are some subtle differences in the way we see things, and we've known that because we've had many discussions over the years. What we are using is called the unique effective action. And I know you're familiar with the works of Barvinsky and Vilkovsky. This is a curvature expansion. Now, the term you're discussing, the Riemann log box, Riemann, it's well known that in this expansion, you can relate it, again, as an expansion in curvature to a log box sandwiched between the Ricci scalar and the Ricci tensor. So the other issue that you face if you don't do things that way is that the Wilson coefficients, namely that of the graviton, are going to be gauge dependent, and you won't get the proper, the correct values. And again, that's something that has been understood since the 70s. you have some choice to reparameterize your metric. If you don't do things carefully, your Wilson coefficient depends on the gauge you picked. So that's why people proposed in the 80s to use this approach of this unique effective action. And it's a curvature expansion, and you can check that unless you get close to the singularity, and I mean really close, your curvature is always weak and there's no issue whatsoever. So I strongly disagree with the comment you made.
So the issue is actually not just the curvature expansion. The curvature expansion also involves the metric because log box involves metrics.
The metric is not physical. So but it's meaningless.
But in any particular gauge that you're working in, any particular coordinate system, you have to deal with it. And using the flat space log box is not appropriate near the horizon.
It is a curvature expansion, and you can check that next to the horizon, the curvature is still very weak if you have an astrophysical black hole. You only have to worry about it if you have a quantum black hole that is a mass that is smaller than 10 times the Planck mass. Again, it's simple to check. The calculated only invariant you have, that's a Riemann tensor contracted with itself. And you'll see that this remains small unless you go very close to the singularity.
I guess we can take the question upstairs.
Hi, thank you. This one's also for Javier. So if I understood you correctly, at the end you say you have a resolution to the unitarity or black hole information issue. Is that correct?
That's right, yes.
Okay, so there's been in the last couple of years a lot of effort spent in recovering the page curve using this quantum extremal islands approach, but I didn't see any of that mentioned in what you did. So can you recover the page curve in your approach? Is there any connection here between these two ways of doing this, addressing this problem?
The page curve is only an issue if you have a violation of unitarity. What happens in this case is very clear. The entropy is going to start climbing or raising at the start of the evaporation. But as soon as you start to have a lot of degrees of freedom, the entropy drops. So it's very clear that in the picture we're having, you're going to have the usual page curve you expect goes up and then down. And basically, you know, the expression I was showing you are manifestly unitary. So we don't even have to discuss a page curve as such because there's no issue.
All right.
Now, in terms of the island proposal, it's not something I'm an expert on, but I mean, it's the results we're claiming is not so surprising from an ADS CFT point of view, right? You would expect that the information is somehow available on the horizon. And I guess the closest to what we're saying in a stringy language might be the work of Raju and his information. I forgot the term he's using. Can't remember, but this. He has a proposal based essentially on ADS CFT to recover the information on the horizon.
Related question. It looked like everything you presented was in the context of spherically symmetric black holes. Is that right? Have you generalized this to rotating black holes and other kinds of things? Or is that something you're going to?
The actual specific calculations I presented were indeed, so in the EFT, were indeed for, non-rotating black hole. But I think it's straightforward to generalize it to rotating black holes or charged black holes. The generic expressions I've shown you on the evaporation are completely independent on whether you have a rotating black hole or not, whether it's charged or not. So in that sense, the result is there.
Thanks, Xavier, for commenting on this. So of course, the information loss is a very important question that indeed I think we'll also pick up later in the panel discussion. But The resolution also depends on deviations from classical black holes, which is the topic of Francesco's talk and research. And at the beginning, you presented a number of assumptions to start with, and of course it's really important to start from a framework, a setup, and see what are the consequences, but it's also important to challenge and understand our assumptions. And you mentioned that, of course, we could go beyond the pseudo-Riemannian geometry. This is one possibility to evade your conclusions. And another possibility would also probably be to drop out your assumption, I believe, D, so namely that there is that there are no curvature singularities. So I think this would be an assumption that could be easily dropped. So would you like to comment on that?
Yeah. So if you drop that assumption, you will have more more options, and in particular, you will no longer need the inner horizon. That it's the source of the instability, or even if you get the curvature singularity at the inner horizon, maybe you will not care if you drop that assumption. And in principle, it's completely fine. So meaning that you could still have a well-defined initial value problem, and if the singularity is integrable, so you don't have geodesic incompleteness. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any, so it's not like, okay, so it's possible. Especially if your quantum gravity theory gives sense to it. Of course, you need to pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. So in GR, we know that, I mean, often when you have curvature singularity, you have also a quasi horizon. That would be a huge problem. But of course, maybe we are assuming that this is not the case, you just have curvature singularity. Also, you need to understand what local observer will measure, because the fact that you can extend the geodesic means that you will... have finite tidal forces, but would you measure infinite energy? If so, does it make sense physically that you observe that? So there are, as soon as you allow curvature singularities, then you have a series of questions that you might want to answer. But in principle, you might do that. You will have more options, more freedom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Would any of the other speakers would like to comment on this?
Not particularly. I mean, I think it's interesting, though, with this idea of non-singular or, you know, compact objects. I think it's been one of the ways in which people have tried to avoid information losses is by saying, well, we don't quite have a black hole. But I guess I sort of feel that, you know, now observationally, the evidence that we do indeed have horizons is, at least to me, I guess I'm convinced. So I don't know, but I guess you were going behind the horizon to try and get non-singularity, but I don't know, I'm going to be pragmatic and say, well, I don't care. That doesn't influence me, so...
Let's divide. I have a comment. So first of all, about the existence of horizon, existence of horizon, and of course, I mean, we think that general relativity is probably be satisfied. We probably have an horizon, so on. But observationally speaking, what we are probing is not the horizon. We are probing the light ring, the physics of the gravitational waves that we are seeing is not physics of the horizon scale. Of course, if you increase the precision, you might get closer and closer, but you need infinite precision to probe the horizon scale, and you will not see any difference. So what we know now more than before gravitational waves is that is the physics of the light ring scale, and also the picture of the Event Horizon Telescope. Even more, we know that there is a shadow, but you don't need the horizon to have a shadow. So, of course, we have more evidence than before, but I will not say that we have seen the horizon. I mean,
I would say probably then Occam's razor, in the sense that,
of course,
you know, it is the simplest possible explanation.
Of course. But I mean, I completely agree with that. But as physicists, I also want to quantify the evidence that we have.
and to look for alternatives.
And look for alternatives and constrain those alternatives. Mm-hmm. But I completely agree that that's the simplest for sure. Yeah, that's totally agree.
I see a question from Abai. Can someone bring a microphone? Oh, there is also one upstairs. Yeah, please.
Maybe I'll ask my question.
Yes.
This is for Xavier. I enjoyed your talk. So one comment I want to make is that I agree with this form of the state you wrote down near the end, where you have some states psi that you're using to represent the black hole, and then at each time step you get one more little r and so on until it evaporates and there's just little r's. And I would interpret that calculation in terms of a stretched horizon, where the psi you wrote down was some degrees of freedom I might imagine living at some stretched horizon to encapsulate the black hole. So in this description, I would not have an interior. But my understanding is that what you want to do is say, this is even a valid way to write the state if I imagine this psi describes the interior with some like geometric description. And my concern is that you're going to run into the firewall paradox. There's no way to run it. There's no way to write down some effective description state with this interior and purifying radiation. I think your response would be you don't run into the firewall paradox because they assume some sort of factorization, but that's actually not true. It's all about just correlation structure of operators. And so in particular, some quanta that comes out of the black hole at late times will have to be highly correlated with the earlier quanta and therefore cannot be highly correlated with, say, some interior mode. So it won't look like the vacuum structure of correlations. And this is all completely rigorous, even without assuming anything about factorization, just at the level of operators. Thank you.
So my answer is that, first of all, the psi you described is not the interior, it's the outside. We're talking about the outside quantum state. And secondly, the firewall argument really is nothing else but the Mathieu argument. And it's, again, a factorization argument. So we this is not an issue. The any resolution of the paradox has to avoid this factorization. And that's what explicitly we're showing is happening if you see the things the way we do.
Abai?
Yeah, okay, so there's several things. I just wanted to go back to the earlier discussion that was happening earlier about what gravitational wave observations have shown. And what they have shown is only, the existence of these dynamical horizons, not the event horizons that were discussed in the two talks up here at all, because that is impossible to see until you wait till the end of the time. And I agree that those dynamical horizons have been seen, their structure has been seen, their even multiple moments can be seen, all kinds of discussions are there. So this really continues with the question that I have with Javier. No, I agree that factorization is incorrect, but that's not really the issue, because as the previous question was asking, we can formulate all this in terms of algebras. And we can have algebra of observables, which is localized in the outside the dynamical horizon and inside the dynamical horizon. And we can see that there is actually an entanglement. And then the statement really is, for example, if I have a solar mass black hole, that actually evaporates to a lunar mass black hole. I mean, almost all of the mass is gone, 10 to the minus 5 times the original mass is what is left, but everything is gone up here. So at this case, in this stage, and the space-time can be taken to be semi-classical, and at this stage I can actually construct these algebras, and I can see that there is entanglement. And so somehow I don't see that this entanglement is just disappearing or is appearing at scry. In your pictures, I don't understand the geometrical picture. So if in fact you are thinking in terms of the Hawking picture, then even when the black hole has evaporated, space-time does have a future boundary. And that future boundary is a singularity, you know. It's not, and I don't see how, you know, if I just take a partial Cauchy slice and evolve it, it will just go into the singularity. So I don't see how this conceptual framework can work there. So if you could explain, that would be very helpful.
Yes. So basically, we're doing the analogon of Mathur's theorem or Mathur's approach. So you think of a nice slice on which the pair particles are produced. So pair radiation are produced, so B and E. One goes out, one goes in. So we're tracking basically the production of pairs and seeing how the quantum state of the black hole reacts. So that's the outside quantum state, right? The side we're discussing. So basically what we're showing is that this quantum state cannot be factorized in terms of matrix or in terms of heads that are independent of each other. You have these amplitudes that depend on the previous emission, and basically the whole object is one big object that cannot be factorized in terms of simpler objects.
Yeah, but the paradox had to do with what happens to scry. So is your state defined as scry, or is it not defined as scry?
The problem, the paradox, is simply that if you look at the entropy of the object that Mathur defines with the factorized version, it's going to grow with n. So you get for every of these pairs a log 2, you get n of them, you get n log 2, and that's the way to... So the paradox is formulated, and that's the most tractable way to think of it. What we're showing is that this is not the case if you have this state that is not factorizable.
No, but I agree.
Okay.
Should I stop? I mean, I can continue with you. I mean, since he is in Perimeter Institute,
Stephen,
I'll continue with you.
And then
I don't agree with the explanations, but I think it'll be. I don't want to monopolize
perhaps
the conversation.
We can go to
and
the
so
next
question. I can answer.
Oh, okay. So Francesco would like
to comment. So especially the first part of your statement. So I completely agree with you that the distinction between event horizon and dynamical horizon. So what I was saying, it was even more like, even for the dynamical horizon, we have some evidence, but we didn't probe the geometry at the level of the trapping horizon, dynamical horizon.
Right.
Then, of course, event horizon is actually impossible to probe. And I also think, like, if you actually form an event horizon, then the loss of information, wouldn't that be something surprising? Because, as you say, like, you are excluding a part of the manifold, so the information that is there is there. It's not against the unitary evolution of quantum mechanics. If you have event horizon, then you're losing some information.
Yeah, we agree completely.
Okay, let's go to the next question by Renate.
Yes, I have another question, yet another question for Xavier. You emphasized several times during the talk that this is just effective field theory. You know, I'm completely blind to UV, so it doesn't really matter in the argument as far as I understood you. So would you conversely say, if we are interested in quantum gravity in the UV, let's not stare at black hole horizons and trying to solve the black hole information loss problem? What's your attitude?
I think I'm going to shock you even more. I think that given our universe, and that all physical processes we understand or could eventually measure one day or the other are taking place at energies below the Planck mass, even inflation, we may not care so much about the UV completion. We have all the tools to do any calculation that's relevant to our universe. But that's maybe a bit provocative. Now, it's not saying it's not important, interesting to find the UV complete theory, but in terms of practical calculations, if you think in terms of Feynman's view, shut up and calculate, well, we have what it takes to calculate.
Well, but of course, you know, we humans, we always want to push the boundaries. So
I'm not dismissing that. I told you it was pretty provocative. But I think from all practical purposes, we have the right tools for the calculation. Now, the problem is that the effects we're talking about are minuscule. And finding a way to probe that experimentally. And I heard some very optimistic people in the previous days. My feeling is that, unfortunately, this is not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, but I would say you evaded my question. You know, imagine there are people around, and there are some in this room who are interested in the UV physics, right? Is it worth their while, from the arguments you made, to study you know, the black hole information loss problem?
Well, I think it's a problem that doesn't depend on the UV until you get to the final stage when you have a quantum black hole, you know, at the end of the process. But in our view, by that time, all the information is out already.
And we're all dead. Yes, thank you.
Okay, so at this point, I would call some questions online, if there is any.
Yes, there is a question for Francesco from Jens Boos. Can you comment on the timescales of instabilities compared to the Hawking lifetime of a black hole? Like specifically, are these stability questions relevant for astrophysical black holes?
Sorry, the second part I didn't understand. The timescale instability compared to?
The Hawking lifetime of a black hole.
Ah, okay, yeah. So the timescale is usually very, very short. So if you think that the parameter is Planck size, then the instability will be Planck time. Of course, if you have a larger regularization parameter, then it can be longer, but definitely faster than the evaporation timescale. So it's definitely fast instability. And this is when I mean time, I talk time for an asymptotic observer, not a local observer.
Any other online question? Okay, so I would then. Is there a question there?
There was one in the middle.
Okay, there.
Yeah, just like to follow up on the tail end of that question. Are these instabilities then relevant for astrophysical black holes?
Yeah, I mean, if we assume that astrophysical black holes are non-singular, then they will be relevant. And also, I mean, this is basically the same mechanism that the stability of the inner horizon in Kerr black holes, and that is, we know it is relevant for astrophysical black holes.
Okay, so in the spirit of challenging assumptions and our framework, Ruth talked in her talk about challenging thermodynamics, and in particular you presented examples concerning slowly accelerating black holes in ADS. Mm-hmm. And I would like you to comment on the impact of the sign of the cosmological constant. So what would happen if from ADS we switch to DS in for the black hole thermodynamics?
So I mean, obviously, once you switch from ADS to DS, then you have a second horizon, and that means that you no longer even have any, well, that makes it very obvious that you're not in any sort of thermal state, although I think it's fairly clear, even for an asymptotically flat black hole, that you're not in a thermal state, because it's a highly dynamical situation. One of the things that I sort of mentioned in the talk, or skated past, was talking about these multiple horizons, and I think it was also when Renata asked her question about Euclideanization. I guess I always sort of think of Euclideanization as a tool, but one of the curiosities, if you look at Schwarzschild de Sitter spacetimes and Euclideanize, and then take the partition function approach, calculate the action, you find that the chosen periodicity drops out of your calculation. So I think there are still a sort of few formal puzzles that remain in that context. I think De Sitter thermodynamics is something that I've always wanted to look at a little bit more closely. But in general, I think I do have some uneasiness about the way in which we go around, or we often go around, black hole thermodynamics. So I think it's a good question.
Thank you, Ruth. And one thing that you mentioned is that, of course, dynamics is really important in black hole thermodynamics, but also in general connecting what we think black holes beyond the general relativity could be, and first principles. Francesco also picked the topic. So, of course, one needs to understand which objects beyond that are proposed that could be alternatives to classical black holes could actually be formed in nature from a quantum gravitational or beyond the general relativity dynamics. So perhaps each of the speakers would like to add something about dynamics beyond the general relativity and its connection to black holes beyond GR.
Yeah, so everything. So I think there is still a lot to work on this regard. So we do have some solutions that are background solutions that can be black holes beyond general relativity, but we don't know if we can actually find those solutions, right? So we can actually form those solutions. So I was mentioning during the talk these objects that are formed, that are supported by the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, so semi-classical effects. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to understand why this solution exists. Like you would know that if you assume that we are in a static configuration and we are in a Boulevard state, we know that this diverges at the horizon. So if we prepare a state which is there, very close to the Woolby horizon in the Boulevard state, it can never cross it because it will form will be divergence. So we have an infinite proportion to do that. But whether or not you can actually form this solution dynamically, it's a much more complicated question that would require full quantum gravity because you will need to understand what is the gravitational collapse at the Planckian size. And there are toy models in which you get these bounces and so on, but it's not very, very clear what is going to happen. But it's a very interesting problem.
So I think actually even within regular gravity, never mind quantum gravity, mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of interesting things that we could explore with time-dependent black holes and thinking of time-evolving horizons. I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of interesting, I'm always sort of trying to think, you know, in what way, just using the standard theories that we have, can we get phenomena that might look as if they're something exotic, but in reality, it's just a consequence of maybe normal energy momentum or a normal system that's perhaps just doing something a little different. So I think, you know, I do think that just even without thinking about quantum gravity, exploring more dynamical situations, I think there's a lot to be mined there.
Thanks, Roop. And next, maybe Xavier can comment on that. Of course, Xavier already mentioned that at level of effective field theory, we have corrections, so those are clearly important. So then I would challenge him further and saying, like, okay, what's beyond these universal logs, and what can we do about that?
So I think the question about quantum black holes actually is very fascinating. And one of the, you know, one work I admire a lot is by Stell, and looking for new solutions in this effective theory that we have would be very interesting. And he's obviously started to investigate that by looking at R squared, you know, Ricci tensor squared and so on, and looking for new solutions. And that I think would have a lot of value, and he's got some numerical results. So it'd be very nice to see whether something analytical can be done.
Okay, so we have time for one last 1 minute question. Or 1 minute question plus answer. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the positive lambda case. You can deal with it to a considerable degree by putting the black hole, the De Sitter type black holes in a shell, and just the way Jim York proposed some 30 odd years ago. And in that case, the positive lambda becomes a tension instead of a pressure. You do get chemical type phase transitions for black holes. And so you can learn things in this way. It's much more challenging to do it without the shell, but nevertheless, there is an approach here that I've done in a number of papers and a number of other people have worked on as well. That's just a comment on the earlier point.
Okay. Any last comment? If not, I would suggest to close the discussion and thank again the daily speakers.